This is The Handoff, a podcast on hand surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Bill Pienka, Chief of Hand Surgery at the JPS Health Network and acclaimed Bone and Joint Institute in Fort Worth, Texas. Each episode, I'll be joined by special guests and we'll review both current and historical articles relevant to the practice of hand surgery. Our hope is this program provides a new, fun, innovative way for us to keep up with the literature, improve our practices, and improve outcomes for our patients. Thanks for joining us today on The Handoff. I'm all by myself today, Dr. Bill Pienka, here in Fort Worth with no guests on a very icy, cold day. And today I'm only going to review one article. And this is out of the February 2021 edition of the Journal of Hand Surgery out of University of Michigan and the VA there in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And this article is entitled The Association Between Electrodiagnostic Severity and Treatment Recommendations for Carpal Tunnel Syndrome. Listed authors are Yuting Liu, Amrit Deol, and Erica Sears. In this article, the authors are intending to look at the relationship between electrodiagnostics, EMGs, and nerve conduction studies, and the severity found on those studies, and comparing that based on severity to the utilization of either operative or non-operative treatment, as well as the duration between their electrodiagnostics and definitive surgical treatment. And the way the authors do this is through a retrospective chart review, looking at patients with carpal tunnel syndrome and what their treatment was. They also looked at patient demographics, age, sex, gender, insurance type, and whether they received surgical treatment or non-surgical treatment, as well as the number of days between their nerve conduction studies or their electrodiagnostics and their carpal tunnel definitive treatment. Patients in this study were stratified based on electrodiagnostic findings into one of four categories based on severity. And this is severity according to the American Association of Neuromuscular and Electrodiagnostic Medicine, their criteria. So either normal, mild, moderate, or severe carpal tunnel syndrome. And as I previously stated, they were also broken down into gender, age, ethnicity, insurance type, and again, their carpal tunnel findings on electrodiagnostics. The authors also recorded healthcare utilization before and after electrodiagnostics to include other advanced imaging or diagnostics such as MRI or ultrasound, whether they had surgical release of the carpal tunnel, whether they received steroid injections, hand therapy, or brace or splint immobilization within 10 months before or after their EMG and nerve conduction studies. And again, finally, they recorded the time frame between when the patients had their electrodiagnostics and carpal tunnel to determine whether carpal tunnel severity, as indicated on the electrodiagnostics, had an effect on time to surgery in these patients. In total, they identified 210 patients with carpal tunnel syndrome that met their inclusion criteria, 71% female, 79% Caucasian, 57% had private insurance. Mean age was 59 years old. And they did note that there was a range of severity noted on electrodiagnostics, and the frequency of undergoing carpal tunnel release did increase with the severity. So among the range of severities, as the authors indicate in the results section, 53% of patients who had severe carpal tunnel on their electrodiagnostics received surgery. And this had a stepwise decrease as the severity decreased on their electrodiagnostic testing. So 46% of moderate carpal tunnel syndrome patients received surgical intervention, 33% in patients with mild graded carpal tunnel, and 6% of patients with normal electrodiagnostics ultimately underwent surgical treatment. When they looked at non-surgical treatment, they did not identify a clear relationship between severity and non-surgical treatment in these patients. So there was no significant correlation between severity and the use of steroid injections or orthotics or hand therapy. They do note that patients with mild carpal tunnel had the highest rate of injections, followed by moderate and severe, and patients with normal electrodiagnostics had the lowest rate of carpal tunnel injections. And again, there was no trends noted, no clear relationships noted between other non-surgical treatments and the severity of carpal tunnel. Looking at wait times from electrodiagnostics to surgical intervention for these patients. They did note that patients with severe carpal tunnel had the lowest time to surgery, the lowest wait time. So there was an inverse relationship between wait time and severity. Their overall median wait time was 77 days. But in patients that had severe carpal tunnel syndrome, the average time to surgery was only 59.5 days. In moderate carpal tunnel syndrome, that increased to 77 days. In mild carpal tunnel syndrome, the wait time for patients from electrodiagnostic testing to surgical intervention was 170 days. And then in patients with normal electrodiagnostics, the wait time from electrodiagnostic testing to carpal tunnel release was 265 days. When the authors did a multivariate analysis, they did note that moderate and severe carpal tunnel syndrome did have a significantly higher odds of ultimately receiving a carpal tunnel release after electrodiagnostics, which I think is an expected finding in these patients. In discussion, the authors talk about the odds of receiving steroid injections and other non-surgical treatment, whether it's hand therapy or orthotics, was not significantly different between groups with varying grades of carpal tunnel syndrome. They again repeat that patients with more severe carpal tunnel on electrodiagnostics were more likely to go on to surgical intervention, and increased severity had a decreased wait time to surgery. So there was an inverse relationship between severity and time to surgery. The authors conclude from their data that electrodiagnostic severity does have an influence on surgical decision making for some patients, specifically patients with severe or moderate carpal tunnel syndrome, who are more likely to go on to surgical intervention and to have surgical intervention in a more timely fashion. But electrodiagnostic severity is not the only consideration for a lot of these patients. So that time lag you see between electrodiagnostics and surgical interventions being longer in patients with mild or moderate carpal tunnel is likely multifactorial, but the patients that have milder symptoms may be less inclined to proceed with surgical intervention and may have surgeons who are less inclined to prioritize surgical intervention without trying orthotics or steroid injections if it is something that can provide a long-lasting relief for mild symptoms. Patients that have no median compression neuropathy on their electrodiagnostics may have a 296-day time to surgery because the diagnosis isn't clear, and they may be undergoing more diagnostic carpal tunnel injections or workup for other potential causes of neuropathic type symptoms in their hands. So that could be, and likely is, a reason for these delays in patients that have much less obvious findings. I think the takeaway from this study is that electrodiagnostics can help us and does help us determine patients who would really benefit from carpal tunnel release. And these patients with severe carpal tunnel syndrome on EMG with potential axonal loss or with absent sensory responses, patients that may have thenar muscle wasting, they benefit from a more expedient surgical intervention to halt the loss of function and the loss of recovery potential that is seen with prolonged severe compression of the median nerve. We know that electrodiagnostics are a confirmatory test a lot of times for carpal tunnel, but there's plenty of literature out now suggesting that electrodiagnostics maybe are unnecessary in treating these patients, and that they increase the cost of total cost of care for carpal tunnel syndrome. They delay definitive surgical treatment in these patients and ultimately provide little or no value in the treatment of carpal tunnel syndrome. In 2016, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons in their clinical practice guidelines did come out and say that they no longer recommend EMG and nerve conduction studies to be done routinely in all patients before being considered for surgical intervention. And this was a change from prior guidelines. And there's often not a true correlation between clinical symptoms and the severity of carpal tunnel syndrome seen on electrophysiology testing. So I don't necessarily think that all of our patients that come in complaining of carpal tunnel type symptoms need an EMG. Now, a lot of my patients get them. I'm in a referral center. I'm in a large hospital system. And most of the time, the primary care physicians for these patients are obtaining EMGs, seeing carpal tunnel syndrome in the results, and then referring them for definitive treatment in my office. And I think that's totally acceptable. What I think the problem that you run into is when patients who have mild or even moderate symptoms get an EMG with severe disease and then come in saying, hey, I absolutely need surgery right now because I have severe carpal tunnel syndrome. And then you talk to them and they don't have any weakness and they only have maybe some nighttime symptoms. And you say, well, you know, let's consider that surgery is not the only option here. Not that it's a bad option. I just have had plenty of experiences where patients' desires and sort of expectations have been shaped by electrodiagnostic testing that is not correlating with their symptoms necessarily. Now, for those of you that have listened to this podcast in the past, you know that I have been moving a lot of my elective type soft tissue procedures like carpal tunnel releases or trigger fingers is what we've talked to, more to a Wallant style in the office setup. And I think that that's prudent for the American healthcare system now, as you know, the financial crunch is definitely on. A lot of hospital systems and individual practices are hurting due to COVID-19. And having patients come in with a clear-cut diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome, whether it's via nerve conduction studies and EMGs or not, just based on clinical exam, and taking that patient and saying, hey, we can do your surgery in the office for a fraction of the cost of doing it in a surgery center or in the OR, you can really provide great care, high-quality care, the same level of care that you'd provide in the operating room, in a comfortable environment for the patient at a fraction of the cost. And if you're able to diagnose their carpal tunnel syndrome just based on your physical exam, you're saving them significant costs and time waste and delays from getting EMGs. And then you set them right up there in the office. A lot of times I'll have somebody come in on Wednesday. I'll evaluate them. Hey, it looks like you've got carpal tunnel syndrome. Here's your options. We could do your surgery in the office. And then later that week or the next week, they come in and they have the procedure done and they're well on their way to recovery. So it's decreasing time from diagnosis to surgery. It's decreasing overall cost and improving not only the patient satisfaction, but the surgeon satisfaction as well. Because when you do procedures like this in the office, you take a lot of the variables out of your OR days that can be very frustrating and out of your control, whether it's nursing issues or pre-op issues or anesthesia issues or the OR getting delayed or getting bumped or whatever that may be. When you're doing these procedures in your office, you're really controlling your whole schedule. So surgeon satisfaction is a big part of in-office surgery. And I can't recommend enough people trying to set up a wide awake local anesthesia, no tourniquet, Wallant style hand surgery program for themselves. In discussing this article, I do think that it would be inappropriate not to mention when I think that an EMG is absolutely necessary for my patients specifically. And if I have a patient where the diagnosis is not extremely clear on a physical exam, I do get an EMG because I want to make sure that that I'm not missing something. I'm not missing a brachial plexopathy or a cervical radiculopathy, a double crush type scenario. Oftentimes, patients just really can't describe that well where their numbness is and if their provocative exams are not super clear. Then I want to make sure that I'm not missing an ulnar neuropathy as well. One thing I find super frustrating, both for myself and for my patients, is when we do carpal tunnel releases on people who then come back within a few months with, you know, ulnar neuropathy or cubital tunnel syndrome that was probably there to begin with, and either they weren't able to recognize it or I wasn't able to recognize it. But either way, I always am sort of disappointed when we say, well, you know, you really need another surgery here, and it's probably something that could have been taken care of all at once. So those are patients where I consider getting EMGs. I also like it when patients do show up with an EMG, especially when they have either a prolonged recovery or an unexpectedly poor recovery, you can repeat an EMG and compare it to their initial one to show, yes, there has been interval improvement. This is just going to be a more prolonged recovery and help coach your patient, or give yourself the information to know that for some reason I released their compression and they're not getting better. Is this an incomplete release? Is this a double crush? Is this something else? And by having a sort of landmark EMG done before any surgical intervention, you do have that basis that you can compare to. So those are patients that I like to have EMGs on. I also like to use an EMG, especially in a severe carpal tunnel syndrome finding on EMG in a patient that has significant thenar wasting, to help guide expectations, to tell you them, hey, you have severe carpal tunnel, you have complete thenar wasting, to be able to guide them and say, listen, here's the numbers. Look here, we can guide and say, yes, we can stop this from getting worse. We may be able to help some of your tingling and numbness, but to be able to tell them and tamper their expectations of complete recovery, I think it's very helpful when patients have independent outside testing showing them the severity of their disease, so that they don't immediately assume that the surgery was done poorly or incorrectly when they don't have complete resolution of their symptoms. I think that the outcomes after carpal tunnel syndrome treatment are something that has been looked at a lot throughout the literature. You can find numerous, you know, thousands of articles looking at the best carpal tunnel release, whether it's endoscopic versus open, whether it's in office versus in OR, whether it's local anesthesia, regional anesthesia, general anesthesia. And I think that the long and short of it is that there's still a lot for us to figure out. And I like articles like this that say EMGs can guide your treatment. They can certainly help you prioritize who needs surgery on a more timely fashion and who may benefit from some non-surgical treatments prior to considering surgical intervention. But I also think studies like this show that we can probably pare down the amount of workup that goes into carpal tunnel treatment and go more by patient description of their symptoms. And if a patient comes in and it seems like that their symptom severity is severe, that going in a more expedient fashion to carpal tunnel release in them likely will provide higher patient satisfaction and earlier return to full function. When if a patient has mild symptoms, you probably can attempt some night splinting, injections, some hand therapy, activity modification, and if that doesn't get them to where they want to be and resolve their symptoms, then move on to carpal tunnel release. I think that we can probably pare down the cost and the time involved in these treatments overall, but I do appreciate the authors for doing this study and looking at it to see if a correlation exists between severity of carpal tunnel syndrome on electrodiagnostic testing and the probability of receiving surgery or non-surgical treatment. That's going to pretty much do it for us today. I do want to thank you for joining us and listening and subscribing and reviewing us and leaving ratings in the app stores or on Apple Music or Spotify. We really appreciate your input. We like doing this for you, and we know that it's been tough right now. It's tough to get together. A lot of our annual meetings have been canceled or made virtual. Networking opportunities are down. Even here on the podcast, bringing guests on right now is difficult due to social distancing constraints, as well as people's work schedules as things have waxed and waned, especially here in Texas. We've absolutely not been immune to the ravages of COVID. It does look like things are getting better here, and hopefully they are where you are as well. We do hope you'll continue to join us, though. Please reach out to us if you have any comments. FortworthHandSurgery@gmail.com is where you can reach us. And we'd love to discuss any topics that are on your mind. In the interim, I hope you all stay safe, and we'll be with you again real soon.
The Handoff is recorded and produced by Bill Pienka for theorthopods.com. Our theme song is by Kevin McLeod, entitled Life of Riley, available at incompetech.com. We kindly ask that you rate, review, share, and subscribe so that you never miss an episode. We'll see you next time.